I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The Baltimore City State's Attorney has a complex and high-profile job, managing more than 200 lawyers and the prosecution of tens of thousands of criminal cases every year. Competing with the incumbent for that job in this month's Democratic primary are two Baltimore lawyers. Today, I'll talk with one of them as our series of conversations with the candidates continues. Former Deputy Attorney General for Maryland, Thiru Vignaraja, joins me. The incumbent state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, has drawn sharp criticism from some quarters as the crime rate in the city remains stubbornly high. Mr. Vignaraja says that if elected, he'll reduce the number of murders in Baltimore by half in 3 years. I'll ask him how and why he thinks he's the best choice to be the city's top prosecutor. Thiru Vignaraja joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Today, we are going to continue our series of conversations with the candidates. Our focus today is on the Democratic primary election later this month for Baltimore City State's Attorney, a race in which three candidates, including the incumbent Marilyn Mosby, are competing to be the city's top prosecutor. While cases like the unsuccessful prosecution of police officers who arrested Freddie Gray in 2015 get a lot of scrutiny, the state's attorney's office prosecuted more than 41,000 cases in 2017. The state's attorney oversees more than 400 people, including more than 200 lawyers, and the salary is the highest of any city employee. It's a big job, and my guest today would very much like to have it. Thiru Vignaraja is a former prosecutor who's spent most of his legal career in public service. He attended Yale University and Harvard Law School, where he served as the president of the Harvard Law Review. He went on to clerk for Supreme Court Justice Stephen G. Breyer, and he served as a federal prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore, working under then U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein. Vignaraja subsequently moved to the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office, where he headed the Major Investigations Unit. In 2014, he was appointed Deputy Attorney General for Maryland under Attorney General Brian Frosch. He left that position in 2016 to work on the transition team for the ill-fated Hillary Clinton presidential campaign. He is currently a litigation partner at the law firm DLA Piper here in Baltimore, but he continues to act as the lead attorney for the state of Maryland in the post-conviction appeal of Adnan Syed, who was convicted of the 1999 murder of Haemin Lee in a case that was the subject of the popular podcast, Serial. Thiru Vignaraja is 41 years old. He lives in Federal Hill. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. And later in the program, we will take your calls, your emails, and your tweets. Mr. Vignaraja, it's a delight to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
So glad to be here. Thank you for having me, Tom.
So, by the way, if folks recognize your last name, it's because your kid sister is running for governor.
She's not a kid sister anymore, it seems.
But yeah, Chris Vignaraja, So I don't need to ask you who you're endorsing in that race. But I do want to ask you what I asked Mr. Bates and what I'm going to ask Ms. Mosby when I talk to her next week or the week after next. In terms of the capacity of the state's attorney's office and the state's attorney as an individual to reduce violent crime in Baltimore. How do you see the job and how do you see the potential to have a direct impact on violence reduction?
I'm so glad you start with that question because I think people do not realize the importance of the state's attorney when it comes to crime reduction and the criminal justice system. Too often when crime spikes, people blame the mayor, they blame the city council, they blame the police commissioner. But the reality is that so much of what they do is reactive. There are investments in schools that have to be made. There are arrests of people that are on the corners that routinely are made by the police department. But the prosecutor has always been, in Baltimore City and many other cities, the quarterback of those efforts. They're the ones that are responsible for the proactive investigations that have dramatically reduced violent crime. And so it was no accident that Rod Rosenstein and Greg Bernstein, whom I had the pleasure of working with, were principally responsible for this 10-year period where homicides were going down, shootings were going down, and the number of overall arrests were going down. And so I'd love folks to understand that the importance of the state's attorney when it comes to crime cannot be overstated. There's nobody who has more influence over reducing violent crime than the state's attorney.
But how is that? I mean, for example, now we apparently are continuing to see no attenuation at all in the rate of retaliation murders between people who are involved in one or other kinds of nefarious criminal activity. How do you, as a state's attorney, or the people, the 200 lawyers you have working for you, were you to be elected, or the police for that matter, or the mayor, how does anybody have an effect on that shooter standing on that street in the middle of that night, settling up a score that none of those institutions had anything to do with?
Yeah, let me give you two examples. But before I even do, I'm going to quote Rod Rosenstein. He said, "Crime is not like the weather. When it goes badly, there is someone who is responsible. And when it goes well, it's because strategies that we know are working are being deployed systematically and in collaboration with one another."
But interesting, because in that speech, Rosenstein pointed to the mayor. To the state's attorney.
Well, I think he is being as deferential as he can, and I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but be clear, that partnership between the U.S. Attorney's Office and the state's attorney's office was one of the anchors of that period of progress where we were reducing the number of arrests, but we were also reducing the number of shootings and homicides. Let me give you a concrete example. 24th and Barclay, right off of Greenmount Avenue, was one of the most violent corners in Baltimore City history. If you drew a five-block radius around 24th and Barclay, there have been 52 homicides and shootings leading up to November of 2013. We focused on that area as prosecutors because of the spike in violence in that particular neighborhood. From November 2013, for the next 18 months, there wasn't a single homicide. That wasn't because the police department did something differently. It's because prosecutors brought a first-of-its-kind prosecution under the Maryland gang statute that had a real impact on the gang there. Because the number of shootings and homicides is driven by very small numbers of violent repeat offenders and gang members. So overall, any particular shooting, sure, we can't intervene fast enough. But in the aggregate, when you're talking about the total number, those are being driven by gangs. Cherry Hill had 700 days without a single shooting after a major federal prosecution that took place there. It's because we can actually, if we're doing it right, identify the violent repeat offenders, build cases against them that are going to hold up in court, and extract them from the places that they're doing the damage.
You have said in other press interviews and on your website that you can reduce violent crime, reduce the murder rate by half in 3 years. A lot of folks hear that and they say, that's some politician making some crazy promise. And in 3 years from now, if he gets elected, who's going to even remember he said it? Or if he does, if somebody does remind him that he said it when they run against him, they'll just say that's the kind of political talk that leads to the great cynicism that we have in some quarters about government in general. How do you come up with this number of half in 3 years? How does that happen?
You know, it's funny. Most political consultants told me to say you're going to reduce crime significantly or that you're going to bring the conviction rate up. I actually thought it was important to give a marker because I want everybody listening to this call, to listen to this interview, to remember that that promise was made because I pledged a specific number because I think public officials ought to be held accountable by specific barometers of success that you can't fake. You can make up conviction rates. You can calculate it differently, as Ms. Mosby has recently done. But the number of murders in a city, you can't actually fake that. But that number isn't pulled out of the air. And when people say it's unrealistic, I like to remind them of two things. The first is that we were almost there 5 years ago. We were 80% of the way to what would be cutting murders in half not that long ago because we were doing the kinds of strategies that made a difference. The second thing I like to remind people of is if we cut murders in half in Baltimore, we would be almost as safe as Oakland, as Milwaukee. We are so off the charts that cutting murders in half is not nearly as ambitious as it sounds. And there are very specific things that we can do. And this is the part that I hope is not political because every candidate says the same 15 words. Let's focus on violent repeat offenders. Let's build a better office. Let's invest in our youth. The question I always ask is, what are the next 15 words? What are the next 150 words of how you take those promises, those aspirations, and you make them real? I'm going to very quickly go through this five-point plan. There are 11 neighborhoods in Baltimore City that have had 50 or more homicides and shootings since 2015. When I made the announcement, it was 10. It's now 11. Those neighborhoods are the ones where we need strategic gang investigations and prosecutions, just the way the feds did.
Prosecuting under the RICO statutes,
That's
for
right.
example.
That's
the,
right.
Which there's is a gang, organized crime statute.
Precisely. There's a federal RICO statute. There is now a state RICO statute. And even before that, there was a state gang statute, which has been very effective, which we used when I was in the state's attorney's office to bring peace to a neighborhood. The second piece of the equation is to match community policing with community prosecution. So the whole office is restructured. You don't have one or two or three prosecutors that are responsible for, you know, peddling your good press to a particular community. These are prosecutors that are dedicated to building cases and bringing those cases into a courtroom for particular neighborhoods. They not only get to know the patrol officers, they also get to know the faith leaders and the community organizations, as well as the violent gangs and the violent repeat offenders that they need to bring to justice. The third part of the plan is to reinvest in reentry. 73% of the people that are released into Baltimore City from prison are rearrested and reincarcerated within 3 years. That's unacceptable. Now, when I told myself I was going to run, I promised myself I wouldn't overpromise. I can't solve that problem by myself, but I can be the tip of the spear. This is what the prosecutor's office can do. We can go into prison 6 months, 9 months before a person's release and say, let's gather together those individuals that are at greatest risk and sit them down and say, gentlemen, we have some bad news and we have some good news. The bad news is that you are at greatest risk of killing someone or being killed within a year of your release. The good news is no one here wants that to happen. We're going to develop a comprehensive reentry plan focused on just you. We announced just yesterday this plan to introduce and seek grant funding, $10 million of grant funding to support the reentry work that's already being done, not only by nonprofit organizations, but by faith organizations as well. So many churches and temples and congregations across the city are helping people return to the flock, but they have no resources. They have no network. They have no coordination. On our website, theroofforbaltimore.com, we now have a map of all of the service providers across the city, substance abuse centers, housing assistance centers that can be a resource for people that are returning from prison. I'm going to pause and emphasize just in a headline form the two other aspects. We have to stop prosecuting victims of addiction for petty offenses. We have to stop prosecuting victims of trafficking for nonsense offenses like loitering and trespass. We need those resources to prosecute carjackings and shootings. And the last part of the plan is to focus on high-impact prosecutions. And Tom, I think this is one of the most interesting things.
What are those?
Yeah. So burglaries is a great example. We've had 26,000 and counting burglaries in Baltimore City. One of the interesting things about burglaries is that we don't catch them because a witness across the street saw somebody, you know, jumping out the window and they picked him out of a photo array. We catch burglars because their fingerprint or their DNA was left on the windowsill. In fact, 40% of the forensic samples, that we collect from burglary scenes match with the federal index, the federal CODIS database of DNA and fingerprints. Those are cases that have a strong forensic foundation that prosecutors can take into a court of law and get a conviction. We need to pay a lot more attention to those. The last example is one of the most, I think, interesting. Baltimore, as you may know, has the highest lethality index in America. So most American cities, even the most dangerous, Detroit, Oakland, Chicago, 1 in 5, 1 in 6 shootings ends in death. But in Baltimore, it's 1 in 3. A reporter named Justin George with the Baltimore Sun tried to understand why. I've got Hopkins on the east side. I've got a level 1 shock trauma center on the west side. Why are our shootings more fatal? He figured it out. Turns out we have a higher percentage of headshots than any other American city. We have a higher average caliber weapon than any other American city.
That's the kind of guns.
That's right. And there are more casings per crime scene. Our killers are literally using more bullets, bigger bullets, and they're finishing off their victims with headshots. That's terrifying. But it does provide us an opportunity because it means that our cold case unit, something I want to create, can go back and look at just the 250 homicides from a couple years ago that are unsolved out of 344 total and say, I can't solve all of them, but let me go look at those homicides that were using 40 caliber weapons, high capacity magazines, and headshots, because the person that perpetrated that crime—
And that's a way of zeroing in on the people who are doing this.
Exactly.
This again, this small number of people committing this large number of crimes
over and over
that we hear
again.
About all
that's
the time.
That's exactly right.
So we got to take a little break,
yeah.
But before we go, when it comes to the barometers that you talk about in terms of measuring your performance or the performance of the current incumbent Marilyn Mosby, is it the homicide rate? Is it the conviction rate? Is it the number of arrests, which happen to be down, even though crime in general is up? Is it the number of crimes that get committed, whether they're people get arrested or not? Is it the clearance rate, which in Baltimore County, for example, is in the mid-70s in percent-wise, and in here in the city of Baltimore, it's up from a few years ago, but it's still around 50%. I mean, what in your mind mind should voters consider the most important metric to decide whether or not the person in this office is effective?
All of those are relevant factors, but I want to answer your question. The most important factor should be, and I hope that we judge this election by it, I hope we judge my reelection in 4 years by this, which is crime overall down? Is violent crime overall down? Are homicides overall down? Because those are numbers that it's very difficult to fake. And if you're doing the right things and building good cases against the right people, you don't necessarily need to have your arrest number go down. You do need to make sure that you're identifying the right people, bringing them to justice. So I think the most important barometer that I want to be measured by is whether or not overall crime in Baltimore is down. And that's what I'm pledging to make sure happens.
Tharu Vignaraja is a former deputy Maryland attorney general who's one of three Democrats vying in this month's primary for Baltimore State's attorney. We will continue our conversation with Tharu Vignaraja after a short break. When we come back, we'll take some of your calls, your questions, and comments. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. To send us an email, midday@wypr.org. To send us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Quick look ahead to next week. This election cycle is being called another Year of the Woman, given the number of female candidates for local, state, and federal office. On Monday, we'll get some perspective from Amy Chozick, a reporter for the New York Times who spent a decade covering Hillary Clinton, including both of her presidential bids. Amy has written a memoir about that experience. It's called Chasing Hillary, 10 Years, 2 Presidential Campaigns, and 1 Intact Glass Ceiling. Amy Chozick is my guest for the hour Monday on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're continuing our series of conversations with the candidates with Tharu Vignaraja. He's running against Baltimore attorney Ivan Bates and the incumbent Marilyn Mosby in the primary for Baltimore State's attorney. Whoever wins the primary will run unopposed in the general election come November. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR, to follow me on Twitter, that's a swell idea, @TomHallWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming. Mr. Vignaraja, we have a call from Alex in Cherry Hill, one of the neighborhoods you just mentioned in our first segment. Alex, welcome to Midday with Tharu Vignaraja.
Hey, and thanks for having me. I had a question about what exactly the job of the state attorney is, really, and also why should I really care about this election?
You know, it's I really hope everybody cares about the election from Cherry Hill to Federal Hill to Reservoir Hill, because crime is out of control. We have a murder surge, the likes of which we've never seen. And the state's attorney has the greatest power to influence which direction crime goes. And I'm going to just, Alex, if it's okay, give you three examples. They're not only responsible for making sure that the cases that the police make are successful in a courtroom. They're responsible for preparing those witnesses, for bringing those jury instructions to the juries and making those cases stick. They're also responsible for coordinating among a lot of different sister agencies. One of the frustrations with the current state's attorney is there's some broken relationships. It's not just with the police. You know, you heard Ms. Mosby attacking the Secretary of Juvenile Services. You've heard her blame the judges. Those partnerships are really, really important to make sure that the system works. And the last part I think I alluded to earlier, which is these proactive investigations, those have always been led by prosecutors. When I was chief of major investigations, we indicted 14 gangs and violent drug organizations in a single year in 2015. In the past 3.5 years, the state's attorney has only brought one of those cases. Those are hard, complex cases, but those are cases led by prosecutors, not by police. It's a really, really important role, and everybody should realize that.
All right. Thanks for that call, Alex. And Mr. Vignaraja, of course, big part of this job is judgment. You're not going to prosecute every single case. You're not going to, you know, you're going to pick and choose. You got to pick your battles in this kind of job. And one of your opponents has brought into question your judgment based on a video that was shot 3 years ago by an organization called Project Veritas. They are in the business. They are generally considered a conservative organization in the business of trying to entrap public officials and various people. There was a very highly edited video that had you in it. It's narrated by an anonymous woman who was also filmed in this thing. This was filmed without your knowledge. It was, in fact, an attempt to entrap you. This guy named James O'Keefe, who is the person who runs this thing, Project Veritas, they settled a lawsuit, agreed to pay $100,000 by an employee from a group called Acorn, who was filmed secretly. Yeah. Mr. O'Keefe also tried to plant a fake news story in the Washington Post. So the credibility of Project Veritas is one thing. On the other hand, there is this tape that's about 11 minutes long where they patched it together. And you are seen talking to this woman in a hotel room and a couple of hotel rooms and some bars and stuff. You're talking about matters that were before the Attorney General's office when you were Deputy Attorney General. And folks point to that as a case of pretty lousy judgment. Your response.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to address this because, you know, you said it right. This is a widely discredited right-wing attack group that's gone after progressives. They've gone after Planned Parenthood. They've gone after Acorn. And there's no merit to any of their claims. The Attorney General's office reviewed it and rejected all of the claims that there was anything inappropriate about our conversations. But it's political season. And it's disappointing that my opponents are, you know, skipping debates and not talking about the issues and trying to engage in the politics of distraction. We won't be distracted by it. I think it is one of those things where I've had a record as a prosecutor, as a public servant over the course of many years. And that record speaks for itself. I was a federal prosecutor. I was a city prosecutor. I was the Deputy Attorney General of Maryland. This is what I've devoted my life to.
But why in God's name were you in that hotel room with that woman?
You know, nobody wants to have their private conversations in what they believe is a social setting recorded. And when those questions are asked, you're having a conversation. I didn't reveal anything that was inappropriate, which was confirmed by the Attorney General's office. You know, this is what they do. And I know that their aspiration is to serve their agenda. We're just not going to be distracted by it.
Let me ask you one more question about it. And that has to do with the consequences of that event. This was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
You went back to work at the Attorney General's office. In terms of your management of the people, and you oversaw a number of people in that office, you will oversee a number of people if you get elected state's attorney here in Baltimore. What were the consequences for your management of those people at that time?
It's a good question. I mean, management is hard. It's hard on a good day. It's hard on a bad day. And I think as a leader, it's really important to realize that we are going to always have good days and bad days and to sort of be a constant. You want to make sure that your team knows that you have their back. You want to make sure that they know what you did right and what you didn't do right. And those are conversations that are had in private settings as well as in public settings. I'm the only candidate who's actually had, before entering an office like this or seeking public office, had serious management responsibilities. Not only was I chief of major investigations, not only was I the head of the Law Review, which had a big budget and a lot of personalities, I was also Deputy Attorney General of Maryland. And you learn in the crucible of those conversations, as well as on bad days, how you weather through that. You got to sometimes take a punch and you got to, you know, to brush yourself off and get back up. And I think it's a really important lesson. That was not the only occasion. We always have a case that goes badly or somebody else that's done something. And it's really important for leaders to be exposed to that, to be tested by that, and to be able to endure those kinds of things, to know that they're ready on day one to take the kinds of challenges that the state's attorney has faced. The last couple of years is an example of the kinds of things that the state's attorney will face. They're going to face police-involved fatalities. There have been 30 police-involved shootings in the last 3.5 years, 12 of them fatal. And how a state's attorney addresses that is not something you want to learn on day one. There's going to be surges of certain kinds of crimes. There's going to be attacks on your character, on your personality, on your policies. You have to be ready for those. You can't allow the politics of the moment to dictate what you do. To the extent that I have learned over the course of my career how important it is to keep a North Star, And to sort of keep your eye on that, I think that's a really important piece of leadership.
Speaking of police, David Anthony Wiggins gets in touch on Facebook, says, I'm running for sheriff in the general election. If I'm elected, I plan to go to the grand jury and seek an independent investigation into the murder of Detective Sean Souter. Will you do the same?
You know, I think it's really important to have a lot of scrutiny on all of these high-profile cases. I don't know the current status of the investigation, so it's a little premature for me to tell you what I would or would not do. Those investigations oftentimes are secret. There may be a grand jury investigation that is unfolding right now. I know that there's a commission that has been working on these kinds of things. But we have to make sure that there is clarity around matters like that. It erodes public trust to not know what happened in a case like that. Some cases are always going to be unsolved, but we got to do everything in our power to get to the bottom of these cases where the public needs to know.
Speaking of police and trust in the police, which in many quarters of our community, it's at an all-time low. We have a phone call in that regard. George in West Baltimore, welcome to the program with Mr. Vignaraja.
Good morning. Good evening, as it were. Seems like all the potential candidates for state's attorney's office has a platform, and as I've heard George, but what is missing from those platforms is a plan to confront police corruption, that is, out-and-out police corruption. I've been in Baltimore City on the streets for over 30 years, and I'm here to tell you, sir, in Baltimore City, there are police officers who monitor and control some corners that will cost you $500 a day. There are other corners that will cost you $1,000 a day. And there are other corners that will cost you up to $2,000 a day to operate.
So you're saying that the police are extorting people on these corners?
Whatever label you would wish to put on it, it's there. And I have yet to hear anyone but Ms. Bosby out and out addressing these issues without being afraid. And I haven't heard you say, how would you address police corruption in Baltimore City?
All right. Thanks for that call, George. Appreciate it.
Great question, George. And on one thing, I'm going to agree with you. And on one thing, I'm going to disagree with you. First of all, if there is any doubt that what you are referring to happens in Baltimore City, that federal corruption trial that just took place removed that doubt.
That's the Gun Trace Task Force.
That's right. The kinds of behaviors and misconduct and criminal enterprises that you're referring to were documented, investigated, and put on display in that federal corruption trial. And that's one of the silver linings of that case, is we actually saw that prosecutors working with local police, working with federal agents, can build a rock-solid investigation and bring that kind of crime and criminal enterprise to justice.
And George is implying or stating that that kind of activity is still going on.
Yeah.
Are you aware of that?
Well, I'm not going to refer to any particular case, but to pretend that that is a unique incident, I think, is to bury our heads in the sand. George, what I think I disagree about is to suggest that Ms. Mosby's taking it seriously. You know, I referred to the 30 police-involved shootings, 12 of them fatal. Ms. Mosby brought charges in not a single one of them. In the Gun Trace Task Force case, it was conspicuous that she wasn't involved in that investigation. She wasn't present at the announcement. She wasn't a part of the prosecution. That is the kind of case that the state's attorney's office ought to be bringing. Those are the same laws.
It was a federal case.
It was an exclusively federal case. And there's lots of cases where state and federal partners work together. This was not one of them. And the last thing I disagree with you about, George, is we do have a very concrete plan. On our website, theroofforbaltimore.com, we lay out our plan to restore faith in police. And the first part of that is creating a civil rights division that is dedicated to rooting out corruption and prosecuting misconduct, modeled on the federal plan. We have to develop early warning systems. You know, $1.3 million in overtime was collected by those 8 officers over the course of the conspiracy. $750,000 of that overtime was collected in the first and second year of Ms. Mosby's tenure. Those are the kinds of red flags that we ought to see and do something about. But if you're not looking, you don't see it. And George, with all due respect, I think Ms. Mosby got the reputation of being tough on police because she brought charges in the Freddie Gray matter. But nothing could be further from the truth. Not only did that case end in 3 acquittals and 3 dismissals, but there has not been a single other successful prosecution of police misconduct in the last 3.5 years. And trying is not enough in Baltimore City. If we're going to restore faith in police, we have to hold police accountable when they do something wrong.
And there are some estimates that the number of cases affected deleteriously by officers involved in the gun trace task force is in the hundreds. Mm-hmm. Cases that have to be dropped because the credibility of the police involved in those cases is shot. So how do you recover from something like that? How do you how do you move forward with these cases that the state attorney's office currently thinks are pretty good cases but can't be brought because of the ineffectiveness of the credibility of those people?
Yeah, Tom, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but you're painting an even rosier picture than is true. Miss Mosby has suggested that only a couple of hundred cases are implicated. That's not accurate. A month or two ago, I was frustrated by the fact that almost a year after the indictment, the state's attorney had still not indexed the cases that were impacted by this prosecution in federal court. We did it as a campaign. We released a list of 2,322 cases in which one of those eight convicted officers was listed as a subpoenaed witness. That's a lot of cases to review. We actually put out a plan for how you should approach those cases, distinguishing between cases where you can move forward and distinguishing between cases where you have to drop the case, where the convicted officer's credibility and importance to that prosecution makes it impossible to move forward.
And if you drop those cases, that's a lot of bad guys.
You know,
that get away with it.
Well, bear in mind, these are eight officers out of a police force of thousands. But those cases, if they were corrupted, have to be dropped. And like it or not, that's just what our job requires us to do. And we can't pretend for some other reason that we can move forward with those cases. At the same time, we can build better cases. We can learn from the grave errors that happened here. We can also put in, to George's question, systems that make sure that we are holding police accountable.
Let's see if we can sneak in a couple of other calls. Joanne in Baltimore, you have a question that's on my mind as well. Welcome to the program with Thiru Vignaraja. Hey, Joanne, you there? How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing fine. Thanks. What's your question?
I just was wondering if he would have handled the case against the officers against the Freddie Gray incident, whether he would have handled that differently, bringing charges.
All right. Thanks for the question, Joanne.
Yeah, great question, Joanne. Let me to start by saying one thing. I think it is sometimes tempting as a candidate to say I would have done something very, very different on a particular case. I think that's actually very dangerous and very irresponsible. I think prosecutors don't necessarily know what a person knew or when they knew it when they made a decision. But let me answer your question. Because if you are considering bringing charges against six police officers in a multi-defendant case premised on conspiracy charges, murder charges, that is based on a legal theory, a novel legal theory that's never been tested before, in a case where you know the whole country, the whole city is going to be watching and using this as a referendum on whether we can hold police accountable, don't you dare try to make that case in 8 days. That is a reckless and impatient decision that you just can't do. So that part I certainly would not have done.
So Mike Schatzow, Jan Bledsoe did not present enough evidence, did not do a thorough enough job in the case. In other words, you think these are winnable cases. So the charges themselves, a lot of people have criticized the state's attorney for bringing charges that overreached.
No,
you don't think that's the case?
What I'm saying is that there is not sufficient evidence that was marshaled at that prosecution to support the decision to charge 8 days after the death of Freddie Gray. Now, that's easy to say from the perch of hindsight because you saw a judge say there's not sufficient evidence to support a single count against a single one of these defendants.
But you're saying that, I'm sorry, then I misunderstood that. You're
yep.
saying, I just want to be clear
yep.
because if I misunderstood, perhaps somebody else did.
Yep.
You just say that the charges were proffered too early on.
That's right. You can't do an 8-day investigation if you're going to prosecute one of the most complex cases in Baltimore City history. But there's another part of that because it's easy to say that from the perch of hindsight. Because a lot of people said, well, Ms. Mosby had to act quickly because the city was, you know, on the precipice of an uprising. I do think it's the state's attorney's responsibility to keep the peace, but it's not just her responsibility. I may have taken the steps of the war memorial, but I wouldn't have done it alone. I would have taken the city council, the police commissioner, the mayor, faith leaders, community activists, and I would have said, listen, we need your patience. If there's sufficient evidence to bring charges, we will do that, and we will bring these officers to justice, and we will do it right. And if there's not sufficient evidence to bring charges, you will hear that decision from me, and I will explain it as best I can, and I will put the entire file into the public record, minus grand jury and work product. But don't you dare compromise the importance of this case, because the legacy of Freddie Gray should not be, this is not the way to address police misconduct. The legacy of Freddie Gray ought to be a meticulous, careful, thorough, patient investigation to get us closer to doing justice. And we lost that opportunity.
Baltimore attorney and former Maryland Deputy Attorney General Thiru Vignaraja is my guest. He's one of three Democrats vying in the primary later this month to be Baltimore City State's Attorney. We'll take a quick break, and we will have more with Mr. Vignaraja when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org to send us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. You can also ping us on Facebook, where we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WIPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today, Thiru Vignaraja. He is one of three Democrats vying in the primary on the 26th of this month to be Baltimore City State's Attorney. His rivals include former city prosecutor Ivan Bates and the incumbent state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby. Our discussion today is part of our series of conversations with the candidates. I spoke with Ivan Bates last week, and I'll speak with Ms. Mosby a week from Monday. You can find all of our conversations with the candidates when you subscribe to our podcast or when you come to WIPR.org/midday. If you have questions or comments for Thiru Vignaraja, you can join us today at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, @MiddayWIPR.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. You can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page, where we are streaming live. And if you have a carrier pigeon, you can send that over here too. Let's go to the phones. Octavia in West Baltimore, welcome to the program. Thanks for your call.
Hello, thank you.
So what's on your mind?
I called in because I'm a survivor of sexual assault in Baltimore City, and I did not go ahead and report my assault because the response is just inadequate. It's insulting, and sexual assault is a violent crime that I honestly believe we don't take seriously in the city. Basically, if something is not forceful enough, women and others are deterred from going ahead and even going to file a police report. So I just would like to know what changes would come about if you are elected.
Thanks for that call, Octavia. And just let me ask, and we're so sorry that you had to endure that, but was it the police in Baltimore City who discouraged you from filing charges? What was your decision premised on?
So basically, I went ahead and I did the kit at the hospital with the sexual assault forensic exam kit. And in speaking with family lawyers and, you know, talking to a therapist, it's really difficult to report a sexual assault in general. But I asked a lot of questions about what the process would be like and what our laws were like. And that information was a huge deterrent. And realistically, any lawyer would say, like, well, this is a fact. These things can be frightening. And I'm like, those things deter me. So essentially, it was not a police officer that I spoke to. But the thing is, I'm afraid to talk to a police officer. And it's because many people I know have had terrible experiences.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And again, we're sorry that that experience has happened to you.
Very sorry, Octavia, that that happened to you, but grateful that you're willing to talk about it, because sexual violence is absolutely a violent crime. And one of the challenges when you're living in a city like Baltimore, where people are talking about the murder rates every day, is you forget these other incredibly serious crimes, crimes of exploitation, crimes of trauma that destroy people and leave lingering scars long after the crime ends. There's a culture around sexual violence that we have to change. That has got to be a more open conversation between police, between prosecutors, between lawyers, between judges, in the community. When we don't when we have a backlog of rape kits, that sends a signal that we are not taking that category of crime seriously enough. When we are talking about murders only and not necessarily talking about the high incidence of rapes in the city, that suggests a lack of prioritization that we need to change. We also more broadly have to understand that there are so many people that are deterred because they hear that somebody went forward with the case and it resulted in an acquittal at trial. I remember, you know, I had colleagues in the office that were so in love with being a prosecutor and so frustrated and heartbroken that they would go to a trial and it would result in an acquittal. And that's happening today, unfortunately, at higher rates than ever before. It's not just devastating the victim, which is most important. It also erodes the confidence of the prosecutors. So one of the things we have to do is to make sure that those prosecutors are getting the specialized training that they need to be successful on those cases. That's about relationship building with the victims to make sure that they understand how to testify and how to be effective in communicating their story. It's also just as importantly about making sure that the police know how to conduct those investigations. Prosecutors are the ones that are on the front lines putting those cases in front of juries, and they know how to make them stick. Ms. Mosby talked about a piece of legislation that she's very proud of in the context of sexual violence. It's one of the few things that she's gotten accomplished in the General Assembly. But the truth is that even without those laws, we already had the ability to convict people of serial repeat sexual violence, but it wasn't happening. And she used as a fig leaf the idea that this law was missing, when in fact the one conviction she had was from before the law was passed. And that kind of passing the buck and suggesting that the laws are not strong enough is one of the ways that we give the impression to victims that we can't take their cases seriously. We can, I promise. The laws are there. We just need the commitment and the confidence to go forward with them.
All right, and I'm not in a position to be able to fact check you on the number of convictions for sexual assault that Ms. Mosby's gotten, but appreciate that phone call. We have an email from Scott who says, I'm happy to hear your guest say that he doesn't want to go after small drug crime. However, drug crime is a very small driver of mass incarceration. Research shows that it's prosecutorial decisions related to plea bargains and felony charges that drive mass incarceration. So on the one hand, we want to put the bad guys in jail. On the other hand, there is a legacy of mass incarceration in this state and throughout the country that many people have identified as a real problem.
It's an important observation. We should realize that the number of arrests overall have gone down dramatically. You know, we went from 70,000 arrests even in 2014, which was down from 110,000 arrests, you know, a few years before that, to 41,000 arrests in 2017. But it's important to also recognize that the biggest driver of that reduction, 25,000 of the 30,000 reduced number of arrests, were actually arrests in district court. These are of loitering and trespass and misdemeanor possession offenses. Those are the arrests that we need to get out of the system. But you're absolutely right. That is not the only part of mass incarceration that we need to combat. This is why I've come out and said that we're going to end mandatory minimums in Baltimore City for good, for any case. I'm the only
By the way, you talk about involving the police, the city council, the mayor. The city council passed a mandatory minimum bill. It got watered down from the original suggestion. And in the Maryland legislature, they did the same thing. Yeah. Again, watered down from what was the original suggestion by Bobby Zirkin, a Democrat, Larry Hogan, the governor, a Republican. But still, mandatory minimum seemed to be the thing that legislatively people turn to.
It's so frustrating because it is the same knee-jerk reaction in 2017 and 2018 that we saw in the early 1980s. When crime goes up, politicians too often look to the theater of legislation in the form of these mandatory minimum bills. Even if they're watered down, they can say, look what we did. That's not the solution. I'm the only candidate that has said I'm not going to take a dollar from the cash bail industry. Both of my opponents have taken thousands and in one instance, tens of thousands of dollars. We need to end the cash bail system. That's a component of it. I have committed to not only reducing violent crime, but also creating the most progressive office in American history. And for too long, too many have said that those aspirations are incompatible. I believe exactly the opposite, that you can't have one without the other. And our city deserves both. If we do this, we're not only going to make Baltimore more safe and more just, we'll also create a blueprint for the country. Nobody's ever figured out how to do this right. And we have an opportunity in Baltimore at this moment to show the world that we can bring down violent crime by focusing on strategic neighborhoods, violent repeat criminals, gangs, and not relying on cash bail and mandatory minimums and juvenile life without parole and the war on drugs. Those things ought to be dispensed with as errors of the past, and we should focus on the strategies that we know work.
Let's go to Kelly in Baltimore. Kelly, welcome to Midday with Thiru Vignaraja.
Hi. So I had a question that sort of went along with the police corruption part of the conversation, and I was wondering, I know that you probably can't speak about the case, but wondering about the Adnan Syed case, and wondering, I know Ivan Bates, the opponent candidate, mentioned that he would exonerate Mr. Syed as part of his campaign.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Kelly. Your phone connection isn't all that great, so I'm going to throw it back to Mr. Vignaraja. You prosecuted that case. You are now involved in its appeal. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I wasn't the original prosecutor, but I was responsible for the appeal when I was Deputy Attorney General, and I continue to play that role. You know, because of the status of the case, I can't comment on it. You know, it is not a popular position that the state has taken in some circles, but what is popular is not always just, and my responsibility is to make sure we do the right thing. I think other candidates have sometimes talked about high-profile cases on the campaign trail. I don't know that that's helpful. I'm not going to comment on a particular candidate's comment on a particular case because I think that these are cases that we would likely inherit. And without looking at the evidence, without consulting with the victims or the witnesses, I think it's an error in judgment to reflect on that. So I'm going to stay focused on the policies and plans that I know Baltimore can use to go forward.
All right, you mentioned legislation that Ms. Mosby pushed in the Maryland legislature. This year we have a call from Zachary N. Govins, who has a question in that regard. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just wondering, I've had a lot of people talking about how we need laws to change, but I was wondering how you will implement your big plans without changing legislation, which would take a lot of time that the city doesn't have.
Thanks for the call, Zachary.
Very important question. None of the things that I'm referring to so far require legislative changes. This is an example of how people misunderstand the power of the state's attorney. I can end the use of mandatory minimums in Baltimore City on day one by issuing a directive with the stroke of a pen that says we will not seek them ever in any case, period. I can stop seeking life without parole for juveniles.
What do you mean you won't seek them? What if they're in place and it's a law and a judge has a case there's a conviction, and by law, he or she is obliged to sentence a person in a particular way.
Yeah, Tom, this is a misunderstanding. The judges are not subject to a mandatory minimum unless the prosecutor files the petition to use the mandatory minimum. And so there's actually discretion. This is one of the criticisms of mandatory minimums. It takes the discretion away from the judges, and it gives it to the prosecutors. So that's what happens right now. But on day one, just as other jurisdictions have done that want to end mandatory minimums, we can do that by policy change alone. I think it's really important not to wait for legislation to say, this is what I can achieve. My plan to cut murders in half, to fix the revolving door of juvenile justice, to restore faith in police, these are things that are within the power of the prosecutor. And to blame others, to inflate your statistics, to skip debates, that I think is just an irresponsible way when it's campaign season, when people really need to be talking about solutions and ideas. This is what I've been doing my whole life.
Well, Mr. Vignaraja, that's all the time we have. I very much appreciate your coming by and talking to us, and we will, of course, follow the results of this campaign as it continues.
What a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for the time, Tom.
Thiru Vignaraja is currently an attorney with the firm of DLA Piper. He is the former Deputy Attorney General for Maryland and one of three candidates running in the June 26 primary election for the Democratic nomination for Baltimore City State's Attorney. Mr. Vignaraja will be on the ballot along with Baltimore Attorney Ivan Bates and the incumbent Marilyn Mosby. Ms. Mosby will be my guest for the hour here on Midday on June 11th. I did speak with Mr. Bates last week. You can hear all of my conversations with the candidates for governor, for Baltimore County Executive, and several state Senate seats as well when you subscribe to our podcast or when you come to WIPR.org/midday. Early voting in the primary begins 2 weeks from yesterday. Primary election day is June 26. WIPR will have complete coverage of all the results of that election. I will anchor that coverage beginning at 9 o'clock on election night right here on 88.1. That's it for us today. We want to thank Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch. They're a small batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. They are available at the Waverly and JFX Farmers Markets and online at bottomsupbagels.com. My guest on Monday will be the award-winning New York Times reporter Amy Chozick, whose new book, Chasing Hillary, is a fascinating memoir of her more than 10 years of covering Hillary Rodham Clinton, including both of Secretary Clinton's presidential campaigns. Amy Chozick joins me for the hour Monday on Midday. Midday's director and engineer is Dr. McDreamy himself, Luke Spicknall. Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produced the program. Jamila Kremple is our digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Stay tuned now. Reveal is coming up right after the NPR newscast at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.